It's a great location, isn't it? Because we have the great Castlereagh connection here with Mount Stuart. So a great location for a discussion about diplomacy and summitry and all of those interactions between politicians and history in the making, and how the BBC and its work also is involved in some of that. Our guest today is David Reynolds, who's Professor of International History at Cambridge. He's a fellow Clare College, Christ College, Darwin's Old College, Christ College, Cambridge. We'll talk about the evolution of summitry with that reference to Darwin as we go. David and I last talked 3 years ago, wasn't it, in a history series, yeah. A BBC history series. He's one of my favourite TV presenters for history. You've probably seen his Summits book and the TV series and The Long Shadow, which was accompanied by a three-part television series as well. Can we talk first of all about what you've been doing in the last 3 years? You're a busy man. I mean, you've got the latest one sitting there at your feet, the latest publication. Yes. Bring us up to speed. What have you been doing in the last few years?
Well, yeah, it's an opportunity for a plug, but we have one of the nice things about academic projects is that one thing leads to another. And so the book on summits I wrote, and then there was, opportunities to do talks about it in different places. And it stirred up some interest and discussion. And one of my principal views as a historian is that nothing I write, anybody else writes, is definitive. It's about starting a discussion, starting a debate, a conversation, if you like. And so this conversation on summits led to a workshop we did in Cambridge a few years ago. I did with a colleague who used to be at Cambridge, now a professor at the LSE, Christina Spohr. And this book has come out of it, Transcending the Cold War, which is really about summits in the 70s and 80s and how they help to ensure a peaceful ending to a confrontation between the superpowers that people feared would end in nuclear Armageddon in World War III. So it's really about the role of summit meetings in helping to bring about a peaceful resolution of the Cold War, which was a theme that's sort of there in summits, and we'll in the summit series, and we'll talk about it. But we've explored it in more detail with historians from France, Germany, Russia, China. Really interesting to do. And, that for me is part of the fun of the academic life. Nothing is definitive. Anytime you write something, it just poses new questions. And that's what I like, So,
and we're going to be talking about the summit series particularly. Yeah. We'll have some clips and talk our way through some of that. But before we get to the first clip, the term summit's very interesting. You start with the book explaining Churchill's connection with the term summit. Mm. Give us a little bit of the history of that, the language of summitry, first of all. Why is it called a summit?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Churchill is an amazing man. I mean, apart from all the other things he did, he gave us at least three phrases which are central still to the diplomatic lexicon today. So special relationship, Iron Curtain, which was the way we defined the Cold War, and summits. And he uses this term, I think the first time he uses it in 1950, and he says surely things wouldn't be worsened in the Cold War by another parley at the summit. Wonderful sort of antique term, parley, a sort of Shakespearean term, I think of it as. Anyway, why does he think of it? I couldn't find any idea in the speech notes for that speech at Edinburgh. I couldn't find anything in his files, but I think it's the time when expeditions to conquer Everest are resuming after the war. There's a lot of talk about summits in the newspapers, and Churchill has used that as a way of thinking about the summit of international politics. And it's what's interesting is it's picked up very quickly. There are cartoons in the book that show, summits being conquered by some of the leaders. By 1955, the State Department, US State Department's using it as a standard term. So it just drops into the diplomatic vocabulary very quickly.
It's certainly more poetic than the language of today, isn't it? Like Brexit.
Yes. And also, of course, it evokes so many images of mountaineering, of romantic art, of going up to the sublime, to conquer something special. So, in fact, I thought it was, it's very, very powerful, I think, and it also brings out what seemed to me, as I worked on this more and more, this I mean, you know, if you go up a mountain, it is exhilarating. It's exhausting, but it's exhilarating. And there's a sense when you get to the top and you see the world below you, it's very heady. It's a very heady experience. And that's what I think happens to these leaders. You know, they get out of the sort of messy, dirty, dank foothills of domestic politics. Mm. They deal with somebody else from the other country face to face.
Yeah.
And it's like, we can change the world. Wow. You know, there's a wow factor about this, which you have to take into account, I think. And summit is a great way of thinking about it.
Historically, what do you think is, what is the first summit that meets that definition historically?
Well, it's clear that leaders have met for centuries.
Sure.
And I try and explore that at the beginning of the book. What it seemed to me made the summits I was writing about distinctive was that, whereas in the past, if one leader wanted to meet another, it took forever to get there. You know, if you're going on horse and cart or whatever,
yeah,
through dangerous country, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily do it. It's risky and all the rest of it. These summits, the ones I'm talking about in the 20th century, I said they were made possible by air travel. In other words, you could fly quickly from one place to another. When Chamberlain goes to see Hitler, it takes him 4 hours to get down to Berchtesgaden. It took Disraeli 4 days to get to Berlin in 1878. So it's made possible by air travel.
Mm.
It's made necessary by weapons of mass destruction. So it's the bomber, the nuclear missile, the possibility that, you know, if I don't do something as a leader, we can be blown out of, you know, off the planet. Necessary by weapons of mass destruction, and it's made into household news by the mass media. Meaning by that, radio and television and just a few mainstream channels. Because if there are only just a few avenues of information, leaders can help to control the flow of information. Today, we're in a totally different world. We were talking about it yesterday. Michael Cockrell and people were talking about it. You know, what happens when you have all the, you know, Twitter, Facebook, everything, all the social media. Now, you know, news is going in all sorts of directions. But in those days, in the 1960s, if an American president could control what was said on the three main news channels, NBC, CBS, ABC, he had it made. So it's, you know, that was my definition of these big, high-profile bilateral summits, made possible by air travel, made necessary by weapons of mass destruction, made into household news by the mass media.
There's a scene you'll remember in Yes, Prime Minister, where the Prime Minister is all very excited about having a summit with the American president.
Yes.
And they were trying to discourage him from doing this because they found the Foreign Office's experiences that one meeting between the Prime Minister and another head of government could undo 3 years of careful diplomacy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the relationship between the officials behind the scenes and the action? What happens in a summit?
Well, I mean, most officials think this is a very unwise idea. Can I just borrow the book? One of the epigraphs that I like very much was from Alec Cadogan, who was a very dry head of the Foreign Office in the 1940s, Second World War. And he's going to Yalta, and he says in this very pained way, he says, "It's always the same with these conferences. The great men don't know what they're talking about and have to be educated."
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the Foreign Office view. And you know, we can do this. We're professionals. Heaven help us, you know, if a prime minister just goes AWOL and does it himself.
Mm.
And one of the interesting themes, and it'll come out a bit in the clips, and it certainly comes out in the book, is this question, you know, when do summits work? Because there's this challenge, in a sense, whatever the Foreign Office says, there are points at which leaders can cut through the bureaucracy, the red tape, the problems. And that's, you know, only a top-level politician can do that. On the other hand, the politician doesn't know all the details. Nixon's meetings with Brezhnev in 1972 in Moscow, he and Kissinger want to run the show. They don't know the details of arms control, all the technicalities, you know, these issues about missiles, throw weights, all the rest of it. But they want to keep all those specialists out. And what I found interesting about the summits of the 1980s and then doing this recent book has confirmed it, is that's when leaders and bureaucrats actually worked well together.
Yeah.
It happened then. It also happened in stuff that Christina Spohr's worked on with Kohl, Gorbachev, and their aides in 1990 over German unification. The same effective mix of leaders and bureaucrats, each doing what they can do and doing it together.
Let's go back to the 1930s, to Munich. Mm. And we'll have a look at the film. Mm. Introduce this sequence for us. This is to do with the Munich summit of 38.
Yeah, well, so this was, for me, this was the first, as I was looking at the first summit, obviously there's big meetings. There's, for example, the Paris Peace Conference, so on, yeah. But that's not really a one-to-one thing. What was amazing when you read the newspapers for the time is, you know, we think now of Chamberlain as a doddery old fool with an umbrella and all the rest of it and making terrible mistakes. When he said on the 14th of September 1938, or when it was announced from Downing Street, that he was going to speak to Hitler face to face to avert a world war, a European war over Czechoslovakia, it was absolutely electric, mind-blowing. And, I mean, the newspapers actually give you a sense of this in the way that the diplomatic correspondent doesn't. And I often say to students, actually, read what's going on in the newspapers at the time. Don't just read Foreign Office documents or Cabinet documents. If you look at a front page of a newspaper, you begin to see what is really mattering in terms of the news. And that was headline news. It was electric, you know. There were people who said, I can remember where I was when I heard that Chamberlain was going to Munich. It's like, you know, Kennedy's assassination. Yes, yes. So this is really the drama of a man who says, I can do this. I have got to do this because otherwise there's going to be a completely unnecessary war which could lead to the destruction of our country because they're fearful of bombing, of the obliteration of London by bombing. I'm going to do it. And so the drama is really that sense of a man taking to the air in order to try and save his country and save the world.
Let's take a look at it.
Imagine a game whose rules you thought you knew, but as you played, you found you weren't so sure. Imagine it's the first international tournament of its kind. You're playing away from home, and you've never flown abroad before. Imagine your opponent is a notoriously unpredictable and aggressive player. Oh, and by the way, the fate of the world depends on how you play. Winston Churchill coined the term summit to describe a top-level meeting where leaders play for the highest stakes at a defining moment in history. But it was Churchill's predecessor, a very different kind of negotiator, who pioneered modern summitry. In the summer of 1938, Adolf Hitler's armies were poised to invade Czechoslovakia. Europe was on the brink of catastrophic war. But then, in an extraordinary move, a brisk Birmingham businessman, armed only with his umbrella, turned the tables on Hitler. The British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, announced he would fly to meet the Führer, man to man, at his lair in the Bavarian Alps.
Discussions between him and me may have useful consequences.
His purpose, to bring peace to Europe. This was the birth of the modern summit.
The air at the summit is exhilarating. It can inspire you to great deeds or blow you away with delusions of grandeur. Statesmen love to meet at the summit.
confident that face to face with their adversaries, they can change the world through sheer force of personality. For 2 weeks, under the gaze of the whole world, Chamberlain raced against time to avoid war. But his final encounter with Hitler at Munich has become a cliché for craven surrender to the threat of force. Neville Chamberlain has gone down in history as a naive old buffer. Yet the reality is far more fascinating than the myth. In fact, it was the dictator, not the Democrat, who lost his nerve at the last moment. And I believe we've totally failed to appreciate the significance of Chamberlain's gamble. He started a new form of diplomacy that would decisively shape the rest of the 20th century. Summitry, Chamberlain's revolution, was made possible by air travel, made necessary by weapons of mass destruction, and made into household news by the mass media. Yet summits, for all their modernity, are rooted in individual human relationships. Two men trying to understand and manipulate each other in a battle of wills that can decide the fate of nations.
He's good, isn't he? He's good. Yeah. I mean, you look very at home, I must say, at the top of the summit, David. Yeah.
I liked it up there, yes. Yeah. Very heady. So.
Shall we give it away? He had amateur dramatic training in his...
Very amateur.
No. But very into dramatic. Your 20s as well. You've got great stage presence and delivering. You really do. We're much better, I assume, at summits today than they were in 1938 because they were breaking new ground, of course, and discovering how these things would work. I'm told, now you can tell me if this is not correct, but I'm told now that when summits happen, the CIA or other people who are involved have professional psychologists who have already analyzed the personalities of the people involved to find out weaknesses in their story, deep information about their personal narrative, whether they're narcissistic, whether certain kinds of lines could play better than other lines. Was that involved, that kind of understanding of psychology, in that first summit?
Well, it was very amateur, as you say. But certainly what Chamberlain... parenthetically say this. One of the challenges, I think, for historian is, you know, we do this off the archives, off the documents.
Yeah.
And sometimes interviewing people if they're still alive. But it's very important to read between the lines of the documents. I say to students, you know, don't take a cabinet minute literally. It was written to, as it were, deceive or to simplify, or it was there to make decisions possible, but not to reveal too much. But you have to read between the lines. Mm-hmm. What I found reading between some of the lines of what Chamberlain said to the cabinet is that he, I think, feared that Hitler was clinically mad.
Yes.
And, you know, if you're dealing with a madman, then perhaps all bets are off. And this, the point of going to see Hitler the first time, he has three visits in 2 weeks. The first is really to check him out, you know, to sit there and look at him and say, and to himself, is this guy a nutter, you know? And he comes back to the cabinet and he says, he's not a nutter. You know, he's temperamental, he's erratic, and so on. But Chamberlain considers that this is a man who, if he decides, if he says he will do something, he will do it. I mean, he actually says, you know, this is somebody who I think will keep his word. So, in other words, Chamberlain is saying, I think we can do business with this guy. It's not going to be easy. Yeah. Now, is anybody advising him? No. Is he talking to people in the Foreign Office who've actually met Hitler, who've dealt with Hitler? No. This is a man who, in the end, despite all that, you know, very sort of mealy-mouthed kind of look about him, he has a real belief in his own abilities. and a contempt, as is true of many summiteers, for the professional diplomats, who will usually say, Prime Minister, don't do it, it's not wise, let's leave it to us, all the rest of it. There's amateur psychology here. Mm. What's interesting to go back to your thing is, your question is, yes, it's much more sophisticated. Now, you get to the Kennedy summits, and we'll talk about those later, you know, there's personality profiles, all the rest of it. In the end, the leaders make their own judgments, and they do it often on kind of gut instincts. So you could have all the psychological profiling you want, but in the end, it's really when I get there and I look into your eyes, or, you know, as famously as George Bush, Bush 43 said, you know, or George II, as I like to say, but the Americans don't like me to call him that. when he looked at Putin, you know, he said, you know, I've looked into his soul. You know, I mean, how do I look into your soul? How do I... anybody? But, you know, that's what you think when you get there. So you can have all the stuff you want in terms of information. In the end, it's about how a leader plays it at the time.
Yeah. So you reminded me of Woody Allen, who said he once got thrown out of a philosophy exam for cheating in metaphysics, for looking into the soul of the person in front of him.
Well, right, cheating in metaphysics. I mean, I will have to remember that the next time I tell the story.
How did Neville Chamberlain, though, get it so fundamentally wrong in his encounter with Hitler? I mean, if there are two things we know about Hitler, and soon find out, is that he is a psychopath, he is clinically mad, and the psychological profiles that came out by the end of the war confirmed all of that, didn't they? And you couldn't trust a word he said.
No. Though he could hold it in at times when he was talking to others. There were other times where he did a, you know, calculated rant. But the other thing then you have to say about Chamberlain is this is all being conducted in a context where people are saying, never again. We are not going to have a repeat of the Somme, Passchendaele, the worst war in British history, 750,000 dead. For what?
Yes.
What have we achieved from it? You know, people don't say that very explicitly in the 30s, but they think it. You know, has my son died for nothing? You know, are we getting into another war? Chamberlain lost his one of his closest friends was his cousin Norman, who was killed on the Somme. One of the few things Chamberlain ever wrote in the way of a book was an obituary, or a long obituary, about Norman. And there was a real sense, you know, I am going to do this because we cannot have another war. Certainly not one where London could be destroyed, and it's all about, you know, a far-off country of which we know little. But you know, most British diplomats, not just Chamberlain politicians, agree that in the 1930s, the borders of Europe are crazy. Countries like Czechoslovakia and Poland don't make sense. There's got to be some revision of the Versailles Peace Treaty. Let's see if we can do it by negotiation. That's the idea. So, you know, on the one hand, I'm taking a risk dealing with this man, but the dangers of a war are enormous. One of the other things really moving in the cabinet minutes, I remember reading, Chamberlain says after his second visit, he comes back and he says, I flew up the Thames and I came, you know, over Dockland, because they're flying pretty low. I look down at Deptford and Woolwich and so on. I look at all these terraced houses and I think, what I can do nothing to protect them if the German Air Force comes over. Because there's this huge fear of bombers just exterminating London, almost kind of nuclear effect. Yeah. And that's what's weighing on his conscience, you know, as a leader. Sure. And that's part of what you need to appreciate about him. I mean, and that I found a very moving thing to read. It's, you know, just saying that, that's my responsibility as a prime minister. The buck stops with me, and the buck in this case is about the lives of possibly millions of people. If you look at the you know, Air Ministry predictions for what would happen in the first 24 hours of a Luftwaffe war on London, astronomical. Again, completely wrong, as we know now. Lots of rubble, not a lot of human lives. But, you know, one has to get oneself back into the mindset of the time in order to understand why they do what they do.
Take us to your second sequence. I think this is Geneva, isn't it?
Yeah.
Set the scene for us.
Right, so now, this is, if you like, for me, Munich is an example of inventing summitry, but basically doing everything wrong. You know, the calculations are wrong, the conduct is wrong, Chamberlain doesn't even take his own note take at the first time. He relies on the German interpreter. He says, well, you know, it creates a sense of trust if I just rely on the German, you know. And then afterwards, the foreign office said, what did you say? What did you say? I don't know. I'm waiting for the Germans to send me a transcript. You know. Anyway, he does a little better the next time. But, you know, so it's totally naive. When you get to Geneva, the Geneva summit is the start of a sequence of four summits. Geneva, Reykjavik, which is something we're writing about, actually we're going to do something for the anniversary in October 1986, wonderful, amazing summit. Washington 1987, Moscow 1988, a sequence of summits in which Gorbachev and Reagan change the character of the Cold War. And where, for me, there is a different kind, summitry is at its most effective. And really that's what we're exploring in that third program.
Meeting face to face can often be a turnoff. But occasionally, when you really look the other person in the eye, it can change them. In fact, it can also change you. When this happens at the summit, it sometimes begins a process of lasting historical change. What really matters is the chemistry between the leaders. The Cold War could easily have ended in World War III. Yet in the late 1980s, the Soviet Union and the United States agreed to cut their nuclear arsenals and the Red Army withdrew peacefully from Eastern Europe. This extraordinary turnaround is often portrayed as the inevitable result of vast historical forces, especially the economic collapse of the Soviet Union. Yet I believe that the pace of the transition and its peaceful nature cannot be explained without understanding the interplay of personalities at the very top. And that all started here on Lake Geneva in November 1985, when two leaders, despite their bitterly opposed ideologies, somehow clicked. What went on behind the scenes when Mikhail Gorbachev met Ronald Reagan in Geneva reveals, I think, a reality at odds with popular misperceptions of these two leaders. Reagan was a notorious cold warrior, hated by the European left. Yet summitry brought out the ardent peacemaker deep within him. Gorbachev, on the other hand, was no messiah, as so often painted in the liberal West. He didn't come to Geneva with much new thinking. Real change in Soviet attitudes happened as Gorbachev gained confidence in Reagan. But success is not achieved by statesmen who think they can do it all on their own. At Geneva, it was teamwork with and between advisors that turned a chemical bond into a chain reaction. This time, against all the odds, summitry worked. This is the story of how the Cold War ended, not with a bang or a whimper, but a handshake.
It's interesting, isn't it, when you just see them standing together, not around the table, but moving around, and as that sequence went on, they almost appeared to know each other better, and I wouldn't say they became good friends or anything, but you know, punching each other in the shoulder and that kind of thing was starting to happen. Very physical.
It was
physical.
A,
it's, contact.
I mean, one of the great things is we have the transcripts of these meetings, and actually more from the Russian side than the American. The Americans usually do a kind of third-person reportage kind of thing. The Russians have produced transcripts in translation as well, and you get a flavour, and it's a very real relationship. There are moments when they really go hammer and tongs at each other. You know, they are, Reagan just has these set speeches about Marxism, Leninism, and its iniquities, and Gorbachev is saying, you know, you don't want to compromise, you have to win, all the rest of it, you know. And then the next minute, they're back off onto something else. And the Geneva breakthrough was basically not so much in the main meetings, but they pushed off to a pool house near the lake, near where I was standing. And they sit there, and it's those images of them behind with a cozy fire and all the rest of it. And at the end of the first day, even though they've had some rough sessions and nothing much has been achieved, they've also had this acquaintance. Mm. And at the end of the first day, they stand in the car park, they shake hands, and they look each other in the eye, and Gorbachev says in his memoirs, it was like there was a kind of electric spark that passed between us. And Reagan says the same kind of thing, that it's real rapport. And afterwards, as they watch the Soviet motorcade disappear, he says to his chief of staff, Donald Reagan, he says, gee, you could almost get to like the guy. I've got to be careful, kind of thing, you know. But that's what it was. By 1987, at the Washington summit, they agreed to call each other by first names, Ron, Mikhail. The wives never get on. They hate each other.
Oh,
they're
really?
Both, oh, God, you know, they're both, you know, real stage dames. I mean, they do not like being upstaged by each other at all. You know, what's she going to wear? What the, you know. But the men, so, I mean, that's a real, they actually keep them away from Reykjavik and all the rest of it. Yeah. But the men do click. And it's a real relationship. They still will argue. By 1988, by the time Gorbachev leaves office, when Reagan leaves office in 89, there's still, you know, quite clear that this is a competitive relationship between these two countries. But it's one where the danger of nuclear war between them has virtually vanished. It's worth remembering, you know, Gorbachev does not intend the Soviet Union to implode. That's one of the consequences, unwittingly, of what he does. He's assuming there will be competition, there will be rivalry, but we ain't going to blow each other up. Mm. And that's, I think, the achievement in significant part of what happens through summit.
The neutral space is important here. Obviously, that wasn't the case. That was another mistake that Chamberlain made, wasn't it? But how important is the geography?
Yeah, I mean, Geneva is a Switzerland neutral capital, like Vienna, which was chosen in 61 for Kennedy and Khrushchev. The idea is, okay, we are not, neither of us is going to be on home turf. So we are not, as it were, making the concession of going to you or expecting you to come to us or anything like that. So that helps, and it certainly helped as an icebreaker, the Geneva one. But then the idea was to move from an icebreaker into a sequence of summits. Reykjavik, which is in so many ways the most exciting and dramatic summit in 86, October 86, was not really ever intended to be a meeting. It was, Gorbachev was getting frustrated that there wasn't much progress on arms control, and he said, let's just meet together for 24 hours somewhere neutral, and that was the attraction of Reykjavik and Midway between us, so we can kickstart the whole thing, you know, kick our bureaucrats and get them moving. Mm. And then, of course, they just pick the ball and run with it. But the intention was then, after Geneva, Gorbachev would go to America, to Washington, Reagan would go to Moscow. And so it was intended that you would then move into a more intense dialogue, a more serious dialogue, once you checked each other out. So Geneva was the kind of reconnaissance thing.
We should talk more about the personalities
and
the significance of it, not just geography and what's happening behind the scenes and what you know about the issues before you get there, but the actual electric charge that can happen between personalities. That takes us to Kennedy, I think, is the next one, isn't it?
Yes.
And Khrushchev.
Yes, yes. Well, so if we've, in a sense, what I've talked about is a summit like Munich that is just, it's all wrong, and a sequence of summits, Geneva, that's successful. If we dig down now into Vienna, Vienna is a meeting in 1961 between Kennedy, who has just started as American president, and we can talk in a minute about the problems he's faced in the first few months, but it's been a baptism of fire, and Khrushchev, who is a veteran Soviet leader. And Kennedy has this real desire to meet this man. He wants to check the guy out. I mean, it's a very Kennedy family kind of thing. You know, we're going to get up close and personal. We're going to get into the hard tackle and all the rest of it. Again, we'll talk about that. It's fateful. But so the psychology is really important. And I think that's what I'm... Psychology and the health of leaders is really important. And that's what these clips bring out now. So.
Let's take a look at the first one. Yeah. We'll comment on it.
The world had moved a long way from the days of Hitler and Chamberlain. Communications had been transformed and information was much fuller. Yet the psychological barriers to summitry remained exactly the same. Vienna had been selected as a suitably neutral capital. But after the wobbles of the last few months, the summit had to be organised in just 3 weeks. Khrushchev made his way to the Austrian capital by train through the Eastern Bloc. It was a leisurely journey lasting a week. Kennedy's build-up, by contrast, was hectic. It had begun in mid-May with a state visit to Canada.
Ce voyage est le premier que je fais hors des États-Unis depuis mon élection à la présidence de mon pays.
Kennedy's French accent hadn't been the only disaster. While stooping to plant a ceremonial tree, he'd also put out his fragile back. In private, he had to resort to crutches for the first time in years. Next came a grueling 2-day state visit to Paris, hosted by America's most prickly ally, Charles de Gaulle. To make matters worse, the French crowd seemed more fascinated by his wife. The president felt upstaged and it rankled.
I do not think it altogether inappropriate to introduce myself to this audience. I am the man who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris.
Unknown to all but his innermost circle, the president was by now in excruciating pain from his back. Throughout his European visit, Kennedy tried to ease his problem by taking long, hot baths. The White House doctor administered injections of procaine into his lower back, as well as a heady mixture of assorted drugs to control the other embarrassing problems with his plumbing. But Kennedy had also asked Dr. Max Jacobson, a maverick New York physician, to fly secretly to Paris and Vienna. Jacobson's New York nickname was Dr. Feelgood, and his specialty was amphetamines, with which he injected Kennedy daily. Some of the president's entourage thought that Jacobson was a quack, but Kennedy believed that taking speed was the only way to avoid meeting de Gaulle and Khrushchev as a cripple. As he put it, "I don't care if it's horse piss, it works."
This was the scene at Vienna's airport when President Kennedy's plane arrived on the morning of Saturday, June 3rd.
It was raining when the Kennedys finally flew into Vienna on the morning of the summit itself. Kennedy cannot have been relaxed in mind or body. By the time he arrived at the American ambassador's residence, the venue for day one of the summit, it was well afternoon. Khrushchev was due at 12:45. There was just time for Dr. Jacobson to administer a quick injection. As the Soviet motorcade drew up, Kennedy, tanked up by excitement and no doubt by the drugs, strode down the steps, apparently in the pink of health. The portly Khrushchev, aged 67 to the president's 43, came up to his nose. Posing for the press, the two men joked awkwardly about their age difference. Khrushchev irritated Kennedy by recalling that in 1959, he'd heard of him as a promising young politician. Kennedy had not forgotten the apparent snub.
I suppose we should, you know, it was only speed, right? It could have been worse. It could have been worse. We now know Hitler was being daily injected with crystal meth by Dr. Morell.
Well, yes, but I think the point is that this is June 1961. Kennedy became president in January. April, he has the disaster of the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, which goes totally wrong. He also has the total humiliation of the Russians being the first into space with Gagarin, first man into space. In those situations, the State Department says, Mr. President, this is not a time to meet. But Kennedy wants to get up close and personal. He feels that somehow his competitive instinct is involved here, his sense of what he has to do. But he's going against all the advice. And the other thing that's interesting about the age difference, and you were talking about psychological profiles, and I mentioned it on the film, it's 24-year difference. When I was looking at this material in the Kennedy Library in Boston, there are the profiles of various Russian leaders and backgrounds and so on. And it says about Khrushchev that he had a son, Leonid, who had died in the war, at the end of the war, had been born in 1917. And I look at this and I think that was the year Kennedy was born. I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
And so I find out a bit more about Leonid. Leonid was basically a spoilt brat, a wastrel. Khrushchev threw him out of the house in the, in the 1930s. He becomes a daredevil pilot during the war and is killed. And I'm thinking to myself, well, wait a minute. If Khrushchev is going to have a psychological profile of Kennedy, he's going to say, 1917, and he's going to think, same age as Leonid. Is this Leonid I'm going to deal with? And that's in a way, affects how they look at each other, I think, over the table. So, here's Kennedy on the one hand, tanking himself up, he's not in good situation, and Khrushchev looking and thinking, same age as my son.
And in the conversation, then, the transcriptions, can you see evidence of the use of those profiles in the way?
No, you can't. Questioning? But, I mean, it's, this is where, as I say, you're reading between the lines, and it's really about one's judgment as a historian. It seems to me that what Khrushchev adopts at Vienna are essentially bullying tactics. He keeps going, he keeps arguing, he keeps prodding. And Kennedy, as we will see, is stupid enough to keep coming back and trying to win an argument on ideology and so on, But they should... You see, the other thing is about this meeting is because the State Department said you shouldn't do it, all the rest of it, and it's insisted, they are at pains to say it's not a summit, it's a kind of, a get-to-know-each-other thing. There's no proper agenda. So they're just... The leaders are just left to kind of, to have it out. It's really, it's a disaster.
Let's watch a little bit more of this sequence.
Over a lunch of coquille de foie gras and beef Wellington, washed down with three fine wines, the conversation lightened up, and the president at last managed to score a few points. When asked about the array of medals on his jacket, Khrushchev gestured with his chin. This one is Lenin Peace Prize. I hope you get to keep it, Kennedy shot back. Or so his press office quickly told reporters. With his charismatic manner and nifty spin doctors, Kennedy was up on points in the PR battle. But in private, the story was very different.
"Is it always like this?" Kennedy asked Ambassador Thompson during the lunch break. "Par for the course," was the reply. But privately, Thompson was shaken that the president seemed to be taking one hit after another from the Soviet leader. In an effort at rational discussion, Kennedy had been pushed on the defensive in an ideological punch-up. For his part, Khrushchev had seen nothing to change his perception of Kennedy's weakness. His disdain for his opponent was, I think, rooted in his experience as a father. He once said, "Kennedy is as young as my son would be had he lived." It was a revealing aside.
Leonid, Khrushchev's eldest son, was born like John Kennedy in 1917.
Покрышев не отставая жмет по следу фрица. Прекрасная машина истребителя Яковлева. Не уйти от нее немцу.
A daredevil Air Force pilot during World War II, he was finally shot down and killed in 1943.
Так горел 29-й немецкий самолет
уничтожен. His father, however, rarely talked about it. Perhaps from grief, but more likely because Leonid's pre-war life had been a decadent chronicle of drink and debauchery. So much so that in 1937, Khrushchev evicted him from the household. For the Soviet leader to compare Kennedy to Leonid was hardly a compliment. He must have known from KGB reports that Kennedy was likewise an inveterate womanizer. If Khrushchev saw his own son across the table from him in Vienna, little wonder he found it hard to take the young president seriously.
How did it work out, ultimately, as a summit?
They got nowhere. I mean, they just... Because Kennedy could not allow himself to lose an argument and seemed to think that somehow he could get Khrushchev at a certain point to say, yes, Marxism, Leninism is wrong, you know. I mean, they just kept going. When they got onto a few agenda, important topics, particularly Berlin, there was no agreement. Khrushchev warned that if the Americans did not acknowledge the existence of the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, formally this was the issue, then there was a real risk of war. And according to the transcripts, Kennedy ended by saying, it's going to be a cold winter. What then is interesting is the bounce off from this. Khrushchev goes back, and all the reports of him in Moscow, he's just jubilant. He has clearly done it with the American president. But, people say he's never been so, brilliant and all the rest of it. Kennedy, and I think that part of that, and I speculate about this in the book, is, part of the consequence of that is Khrushchev thinks, okay, if he has accepted this defeat in June, if he's let me build the Berlin Wall, which happens in August, then I've got the initiative. And it's at that point that Khrushchev decides, okay, I'm going to go one further. I'm going to put nuclear weapons into Cuba to protect our satellite in the Western Hemisphere, 90 miles off the Florida coast, Castro. So in a sense, I think that it's part of Khrushchev's decision to take the big gamble. He thinks he's won it over Kennedy. Kennedy is really shaken by the experience. And one of the conclusions he comes to, and he says this in some of the conversations afterwards, is we have got to find somewhere to show the Russians that we can be tough. And I think Vietnam is the place to do it. Now, at that stage, what Kennedy does is simply to put in what are called advisors, military advisors. Mm. But there's something like 16,000, quote-unquote, military advisors by the end of the Kennedy presidency, as well as a big series of rhetorical statements about why Vietnam matters to us, to the Americans. And I would say that certainly Kennedy makes it harder for his successor to pull back from Vietnam. It's not clear what Kennedy would have done had he lived. That's always the great speculation. But he makes it harder for Johnson, whose inclinations are to be a domestic president, a domestic reformer, not, as he says, to get involved in that bitch of a war.
Yeah.
He makes it harder for Johnson not to keep up the line, you know, and do more and more and more. So what you see here is, I think, two leaders who draw conclusions from this. Khrushchev saying, I can take an even bigger risk over Cuba. Kennedy saying, we've got to do something to show we're tough, which leads you into two of the biggest crises of the 1960s. And this, I think it's not unreasonable to say, are spinning out to a significant extent from what happens across that table.
Gosh. I mean, how far do you want to take this analysis? If Khrushchev's son hadn't been born in 1917... If he hadn't died, if he hadn't been a womanizer and a drunk...
We've never had the Cold War at all. No, I think absolutely that's right. No, I mean, yes. Let's keep going. Well, of course, you have to be careful. I mean, this is... But you see, I think that this is part of the fun of it is, and the challenge of it is actually that... is not to be completely literalistic about the documents. The documents are, I believe, what means that I am not writing fiction. I'm not writing a novel. And if you disagree with me, I can, you know, the footnotes are there. You can say, go and look at it, you know, all the rest of it. But how we interpret the documents is always going to be different. I mean, you look at these things differently from the way I would. I mean, we're different people. Mm. And that's why there is always room for argument. Peter Heil, the great Dutch historian, he said, you know, history is argument without end. I think it's rational argument. I think it's reasonable argument. There are points at which I could say, well, I think you're wrong. And I would be legitimate in doing so. But in the end, there's a lot of room for maneuver. So my part of the fun, I think, is just going a little bit further than pure literalism in the documents and thinking about these bigger implications.
What do you think has been in this period of summits, as you've defined it, which is in the period of air travel, what do you think has been the most disastrous summit for the world?
Well, I think you'd have to go back to Munich, really, or to that sequence of summits, because I think what's interesting is that, of course, I said briefly in that clip at the beginning that although Chamberlain is regarded as the appeaser, it's actually Hitler who blinks at the last minute.
Yeah.
There's three meetings, Berchtesgaden, Godesberg, and then Munich. After the Godesberg meeting, where it's clear Hitler is not going to move very much. The British cabinet revolts, and they say to Chamberlain, you can't do any more of this. Even the foreign secretary, Lord Halifax, revolts. Chamberlain is and the French do as well. And basically, on the 28th, the morning of the 28th of September 1938, the British are preparing for war. Trenches are being dug, air raids are being, you know, precautions are being developed, and so on. As in a wonderful letter from the historian Arnold Toynbee I found in an American archive, where he wrote to an American 2 weeks later in October after the crisis had been settled, and he said, you know, you can't imagine what it was like in London that morning. And then he goes through this sense, he's, you know, of how many million people might be dead within a week. Yeah. And he said, it's not just that, it's the sense that civilization is going to be blown away as well. He's a historian of civilization. But, you know, like, I mean, Harold Macmillan later on very sapiently said, you know, we thought about air bombing in 1938 like nuclear war in the 1960s. Yeah. Yeah. And Chamberlain gets up in the House of Commons. I mean, it's the most amazing theater. And he does this long speech explaining why, you know, the meeting at Gettysburg, what had happened, what had worked, what hadn't worked. And basically, he's getting to the end of saying, you know, we really now have to prepare for war.
Yeah.
And at that moment, a telegram comes through to the Foreign Office indicating that Hitler has decided he's willing to have another meeting. Because Hitler has lost his nerve. lost his nerve, partly because he knows the army isn't ready, partly because he's, again, it's a very touchy-feely thing with leaders. He spends the previous afternoon watching a German armored division go up the Wilhelmstrasse, and it's a sort of parade event. And what strikes him is that the people are just turning away, they're not cheering, all the rest. He has this sense, you know, German people aren't ready for war. And plus the fact that Mussolini makes it clear the Italians won't come in. And Hitler just basically said, just loses his nerve. He kicks himself all the way through 1939 afterwards, and he won't do it again over Poland. But he basically says, yes, we'll have another meeting. So this telegram comes in. Alec Cadogan, this crusty Foreign Office official, gets it. It's decoded. It's given to him. He looks at it. And he knows, he does as near as any Foreign Office official does to a sprint from King Charles Street down across, you know, to Westminster. He still takes his umbrella with him. You know. So you have pictures of him just racing into the Commons, going to the gallery, you know, getting the attention, I think, initially the Foreign Secretary and so on. And this message is passed down the road to Chamberlain, as he said. And he looks, you know, he looks at it, and then Harold Nicholson, who was in the gallery, he was in the Commons, he said, you know, suddenly his eyes just lit up. He looked like a different person. And then he says, I can now tell the House that Herr Hitler has agreed to a... And it just erupts. It's the most, you know, people throw their order papers in the air, all the rest of it. I mean, he is mobbed, all the rest of it. And Churchill sits there, glaring like this. And after a while, he goes over to Chamberlain and he says, you were damn lucky. Churchill's view was that Chamberlain should never have done that. That Churchill's instinct is to call Hitler's bluff.
Yeah.
To tough it out, okay, maybe there will be a bombing, but his psychological reading is Hitler, you know, is the guy will back off or whatever.
He's a bully, you stand up.
Well, that's right, you know. And so, you know, you're back with basic instincts about psychology. Mm-hmm. Chamberlain says, you know, let's find out if this is a rational man. Churchill says, we don't deal with bullies, you know. And no amount of psychological profiling is going to change that. That's who they are as people. But it's a really striking moment. Yeah. The other thing, of course, that is so funny about this whole thing is that whereas Churchill is completely right about Hitler and had never met him, Churchill is utterly credulous about Stalin. All through the war, he's keen to meet Stalin. He believes that Stalin's a man he can do business with. There's all these problem people in the back of the Kremlin, you know, but, you know, dealing with, you know, rational guy, doesn't rant like Hitler, all the rest of it, you know, tough and all the rest of it, but gives his word. And Churchill, amazingly, comes back from Yalta in 1945, February 1945, he tells a meeting of ministers, it's a larger meeting than just the cabinet, he says, you know, you just think, how could a guy say this? But he says it, it's in Hugh Dalton's diary, he says, Neville Chamberlain believed Hitler, he could trust Hitler. He was wrong. But I don't think I'm wrong about Stalin. You know, he's looked into the eyes, he's looked into the soul, whatever it is, you know. Yeah, yeah. His last private secretary said, you know, this was always just a blank spot. You know, he would ask Churchill, even in the, you know, the late 50s, after retirement, about Stalin. You know, Stalin never broke his word. You know, so, you know, we're back with this fascinations of psychology. And so this is why I say I think, you know, it's really important for historians to study the big structural issues of history and, you know, economies changing and society's changing. It's really important to, you know, think about larger cultures and so on. Mm. But there are times when it just actually matters that one person is looking into the eyes of another and seeing something rightly or wrongly.
Or just someone they like.
It makes a difference. Yeah. Yeah.
Incidentally, I don't want to hog all the time here, because I could talk to David all day. We'll take a question or two from you in a moment. I'll just ask one more question.
Yes, okay.
Because I think that was Munich was your example of the most disastrous of summits. Yes. I think you've told us Reykjavik was probably your pick for the successful one. That's making the judgment in terms of the outcome of the summit and how for the world. But don't politicians sometimes have summits simply for the effect at home, to make them look strong and to get a good photo op?
Yes, I mean, the PR side of it is very, very important. I mean, the other thing that's worth saying is that the period I was particularly interested in was these summits of the World War II, Cold War period. In the late 20th century, early 21st century, summits have become more formalized and bureaucratic, you know, European summits, all the rest of it, where it's all, to a large extent, choreographed and planned and scripted beforehand, and the issue is just really what's said in the communique, and then, you know, how you package it at home. But I think summitry has come back again in recent years because we can no longer feel that the world is a sort of safe place in the way there was this sort of feeling in the immediate post-Cold War era.
Yes, but they do still look like the end of... nowadays, summits look like the end of the game rather than the start of the game, don't they?
I mean, somebody who I think is interesting here is Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, because Merkel has taken it upon herself, you know, given, as it were, let's not be mince words, given the reluctance of British leaders to take any position on foreign policy of any significance. But, you know, she is actually the person who is going around, who is trying to act as an interpreter between Putin and the West. Of course, she has Russian. Trying to act as an interpreter between Erdogan and the West. You know, you can argue whether this is right or not, but her conviction is, I think, very much that if you don't have these spaces to have some kind of conversation... The dangers of polarity and misunderstanding are worse. And so I think, you know, the point of summitry, the need for summitry is still there. And the risks and the benefits are always equally balanced.
Yeah.
And so it's always a judgment call. But...
Some questions. Gentlemen here, let's get a mic to you.
Since Angela Merkel speaks fluent Russian, there's a potential for her relationship with Putin to be more effective than he would have with other leaders. So the West could use her to try and have a conduit to him. But it works two ways, and he could try and manipulate her.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the point in him antagonizing her by bringing a dog into the room when they met in Russia, when he knows she's afraid of dogs?
Well, that's psychological warfare. I mean, you know, you want to see them what... I mean, Putin is not treating anybody as his friend. I mean, an interlocutor is not necessarily, you know, a friend. I mean, he's going to play this for what it's worth. She's going to play it for what it's worth as well from her side. But I think her feeling is that if it's just megaphone diplomacy from afar, you know, there's a real danger of that. And there is a space in which just trying to have a discussion works. But of course, yes, it's a risk. I mean, Putin is running a country. You know, Putin is a survivor from Leningrad. Literally, I mean, his parents were in siege. He was involved in Leningrad at the worst time in the 1990s when the food supply and everything collapsed. You know, this is a man who believes you have got to, you know, get your elbows out. He is also a man who has, like many Russians, felt utterly humiliated by the collapse of their country under Yeltsin in the 1990s. And he's always going to do it tough with Western leaders. You know, he's going to play those kind of tricks and see what they're like and see, you know, how they respond. You know, whether actually communicating with him in this sort of way will change things is an open question. But Merkel definitely believes it's worth doing that kind of thing. And, I mean, if you know, you mention the dog, but, I mean, there's a wonderful picture which we actually use for a blog we did where she's meeting Putin on another occasion and she suddenly jabs at his lapel at a badge, and she says, "What the hell is that?" And Putin, it's a really good picture, actually, because Putin is really quite surprised. She's jabbing at him, and he's looking down, and she is very much in command there. So, you know, she can play the game as well, I think.
The fact that she was brought up in the East, her father, a pastor, moved the family from the West to the East before the wall was built. She feels sympathy towards the refugees, and this has influenced her policy of bringing them in without consulting the countries between Germany and Turkey. So that has antagonized. That wasn't very diplomatic.
A summit might have helped.
Yeah.
Let's take some more, another couple of questions there, and then, gentlemen, here, we're going to go to 12:15, so let's see how many more we can get in. I know a few others want to ask a question. There we go. Whoever's got the mic, over to you.
Just kind of following on from the Angela Merkel thing, it's taken us the guts of an hour to mention a woman. So I wonder, does the fact that a man meets a woman in this context change the dynamic? Mm. And are there any examples where, you know, it's been really, really important, either that it's been a man and a woman or two women?
Mm. Well, there is, it has to be said, there is a limited repertoire of examples to go on. If you take two significant stateswomen on the world stage, Thatcher and Merkel, they have behaved very differently. Thatcher's instincts were certainly in public and to a significant extent in private not to do diplomacy in the standard sense. And that her technique would really be to use her position as a woman to embarrass men into doing things that they wouldn't otherwise do. You know, so in a sense, whereas if it was purely a meeting of men and you kept banging the table, they say, "Shut up," or they go to the pub and sort it out. She didn't do that. She didn't do that with any. They didn't do that with her. And famously, when Helmut Kohl tried to get on personal terms with her, and he said, "Let's go down to my favorite restaurant, at home and eat pig's trotters," she gets back in the plane and go back to London, and she kicks off her shoes and she says, "My God, that man is so German." her way of handling diplomacy in that sense works. She gets certain things, particularly on the budget, from EU leaders that are sick to the teeth with her, but she persists. Now Merkel is a different kind of person and a different kind of temperament. And although she can play it tough, she is also believed in this business of being a kind of go-between and a kind of a filter. She's also, interestingly, for somebody, with this very sort of trained and scientific background who's often cautious, she did make a really gut instinct decision about refugees, which, yes, didn't consult the Eastern Europe, Central Eastern Europe, and they're still angry about it, and they're bound to be, and her own public, and there's a huge backlash. But then, of course, part of what's interesting here, and we haven't talked about this either, is the historical burden that leaders carry in different countries.
Yeah.
And, leaders like Chamberlain and Churchill and Thatcher are conscious of being from a country which thinks of itself as running the world.
Yeah.
And they do it in different ways. Merkel is a leader, and the same would be true of someone like Helmut Schmidt, who was a significant global figure in the 70s, very conscious of carrying the burden of the Nazi past. So a country that needs to lead, wants to lead and needs to lead by this time in our history, but can't be too overt because it just rubs up all those historical issues again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the relationship between summits and democracy. And as I listened to your very good presentation, I thought, these people are almost monarchs. And I was thinking about Tony Blair's meetings, informal summits with George Bush on ranches in the States and so on.
Mm.
And in a sense, the deal's done by people.
Mm.
Individuals with opinions and certain types of smile, and as you say, locked eyes. And so, and then it comes back to the Commons and everybody says, yeah, we'll do that. So there's a kind of a democratic vote, but there, in a way there isn't either, because people are acting as monarchs.
Mm. Captains of the world.
Yes, well, it's, and of course they're doing something that monarchs had done for centuries in one way or another, even though it was, more difficult to arrange and more risky. I think that part of what pushes these leaders in this direction is the feeling that after the First World War, that war had come about because of secret diplomacy, about deals made in closed rooms, about diplomats who failed to avert a crisis in July 1914 from exploding into a war, because they were too indolent, they were off on holiday, they didn't understand what was going on, whatever. And then, of course, during the war, there's all sorts of further secret deals between governments, the Allies in particular. I mean, classically over the Middle East, you know, we sign agreements with the French, with the Arabs, with we talk about, you know, homeland for Palestine, and then somebody kind of looks at it and they says, oh, my goodness, you know, what a mess we've got into. How do we sort out this tangle? These agreements conflict with each other, you know, and that, of course, is part of still of the mess in, yes, you know, Middle East today. So there is a very strong movement for saying diplomacy is now too important to be left to diplomats, you know, behind closed doors. And the League of Nations Union after the First World War, the huge way in which the movement for women's suffrage, which achieves a significant success in 1918, then carries on in terms of its sort of momentum, is into a peace movement, into a movement that says, you know, we must ensure, the people must now ensure that leaders, you know, that governments don't get us into this mess again. And what the politicians do is, and I think Chamberlain is in this category, is say, look, you know, I'm the voice of the people. I'm acting for the people. And so they are empowered by the sense that they are democratic monarchs. You know, they have been elected by full suffrage. So I think you're right, but the relationship between the monarchical and the democratic is a complicated one, and I think it grows out of...
Because they have a mandate.
They have a mandate.
They have a mandate for the summit. Yeah. Gentleman at the back.
This falls out of the last question, actually. We've heard so much about personalities and individuals and the impact they have on meeting one another and the psychological aspects of that. I'm thinking of the circumstance where a state or a polity is represented by two first ministers, co-equal, going forward into international negotiations. How well do you think that might work?
a double-headed summit.
A double-headed summit.
Yes. Can you do that? Could you do that? Does it have to be one-to-one?
I mean, it would depend to a huge extent on the chemistry of the two first ministers and the degree to which they agreed or could find a modus vivendi, really.
And whether they're at the foothills or the summit.
Summits, yes. I don't think there's anything, as it were, technically that makes it impossible, but as I've tried to say again and again, we're talking here about a space in which personalities matter.
Yeah.
I certainly am not trying to bring back a kind of 19th century Carlyle great man view of history, because there are so many dynamics to history. What I'm trying to say is that I think there are points in history where leaders still matter, and the chemistry between leaders still matter, and the chemistry within the team still matter.
Would you have described, just to stay with the Northern Irish example, the negotiations around the Good Friday Agreement, leading to the Good Friday Agreement, would you have described that as a summit?
In parts, yes. But, I mean, what's fascinating about that, and, I mean, there's still obviously, you know, more to find out, but is, I mean, it's one of the great diplomatic achievements of recent times, and it goes on so many levels. It goes on the level of officials. It goes on in terms of secret contacts behind the scenes.
Sure.
It involves international diplomacy in the sense of, you know, when are American leaders going to put their weight in this. It involves effective chemistry between leaders in London and Dublin.
Yes,
you know, so it's Major and Reynolds.
It's not as simple as a bilateral.
It's not simple.
No.
It's very complicated. No. And of course, this came up yesterday in the session with Michael Cottrell was involved in that. You know, it could not have happened without a good deal of secrecy, because that kind of thing, you know, is really, if any of it gets out too early, then the whole thing is blown out of the water. So, you know, the elements of that are incredibly different, and it takes time. It takes time to build trust of that sort of level. So, and most politicians do not have time. They want answers, they want results soon for the next election or for the next week or whatever
it is. The next news cycle.
You know, so it's, you know, so if that kind of thing works, it is a miracle, really.
Got 1 minute left.
Right.
Summit, summitry, I guess the term is summiteer, mm-hmm. someone who is, you know, an accomplished figure within the world of summitry. Who tops your list? The most accomplished summiteer we have ever seen. Who is that person?
I would have to pass on that because I'm not sure. I think they all have strengths and flaws. I mean, even the best of them. And I think part of that is that, you know, you're really pushing yourself here beyond what is sensible. I mean, I've said in various times, you know, okay, it all looks very grand, but let us reduce it to familiar things. In some ways, this is like a date, going on a blind date, you know. I mean, or it's like a business deal. Yeah. You know, who's going to win this one out?
Yeah.
Or it's like going and talking to a used car salesman. You really don't know what's under the bonnet and all the rest of it. Mm. And you're doing it usually now with considerable jet lag.
Yeah.
If you think what we're like when we come back from holiday, you know, do 5 hours transatlantic or something like that.
Yeah.
You probably, you know, most of these guys have got serious digestive problems by the end of it, the food and all the rest of it. And of course, famously, George Bush the First threw up over the Japanese Prime Minister at one summit, a sushi too far, as it were. But, you know, I mean, if you're doing all that and then you are still trying to be sensible, sapient, you know, you're properly briefed and also able to take that moment where your opposite number gives you just that chink and you go into, you know, how can any person do that ever accomplish? So, you know, most of these summits are ones where, you know, there's successes and weaknesses. Where it works, and this is why I go back to this amazing chemistry of Reykjavik over those 2 days, is just that it's like both those guys find themselves on the same side, Reagan and Gorbachev, because they have that basic belief they want to, you know, get rid of nuclear weapons. Reagan's always had it. It's this sort of radical nature in him. Gorbachev's got it really big after Chernobyl, which is, of course, April 86. Absolute disaster for the Russians. And this is October 86. But this is the point, you know, where they kind of say,
there's always a context.
We can do this. Yeah. We can do this.
Yeah.
And it's amazing where they just go almost to the brink in those last few minutes.
Wish we had more time. We could have gone into the counterfactuals, the what-ifs,
because we
wanted to do the Putin-Trump summit of the future.
Putin, or that would have been...
You know, I was gonna,
can we do that this afternoon?
No, we really had a time on that, because I wanted... Yeah, we could have talked about which direction the psychopathic stare would move in.
Yes, all of that.
But we have no time for that. So let's thank David Reynolds. Wonderful, David.
Thank you very much.